Boom, here we go again. If you have this, kind of mute yourself and turn your camera off. That saves. Bandwidth, excuse me. So anyway, let's get started. So today we'll be talking about shame and unworthiness, you know, the neurobiology of it. So it's a topic I've been exploring a lot in the last, especially 6 months, I guess. And I started studying neurobiology, as a lot of you know, and I always say, you know, it's not just when you do research. A lot of times it's me search. You know, you're searching things that impact you or people around you. You, me, has a vested interest in what you're doing. And so, you know, so I did my me search on this because, again, I'm always looking at addictions. Why do people fail? Why do they get sober and then relapse? And then that kind of spreads out. A couple people, you know, if you're hypnotist, NLP, or how many times you see people, you know, we help them. And they lose weight or they stop smoking, they make major changes, and then it doesn't take very long, or sometimes could be a couple years later, they seem to backslide back to that old behavior. Why? What's going on? And so, you know, and they always, and addiction keeps doing more research and looking at things and saying things like, you know, it's a disease of connection. But here's a different way to look at it, right? And that is shame and unworthiness, you know? Guilt is, so first of all, we're going to start with what's the difference between guilt and shame. Guilt and shame, or shame. Guilt is, I made a mistake. And then there's different levels of guilt. There's healthy guilt, there's unhealthy guilt, you know, and almost like, and then shame is, I am a mistake. And one way to look at it is, you know, there's guilt, there's healthy guilt, unhealthy guilt, toxic guilt, which is shame. And we'll talk a little bit about that in a moment, right? So what's the problem? Well, one of the problems with using a word like shame or unworthiness even or guilt is you're using a psychological construct or a psychological term for basically what's a physical sensation that's not standardized across people. People feel these sensations differently, you know? And so that's one problem. Another problem, it's a very loaded word. Right? Shame or guilt or unworthiness, right? So I think my internet connection's not doing well today, probably because it's Christmas time, but it's a loaded word. People bring a lot of baggage into what that word means. So you want to be aware of that, right? So it's very cultural. You know, a lot of cultures, they don't want to talk about shame, right? They don't want to talk about shame. You know, especially if it comes from childhood, things like that. So that brings up denial. You know, oh no, my childhood was perfect, or whatever it was, or this event did not bother me, right? And then of course there's, it's the same about shame. You know, you can get shame about shame. You know, it's the same. It just keeps doubling up. And basically all of these things, it's a protective measure, right? Lastly, when you talk about things like, especially toxic guilt or shame, it's how do you use words to describe what's basically indescribable? It's a sensation, you know? So you're trying to use a construct, and then you have to consciously think about how to say it, you know? And of course, those of us trained in NLP and hypnosis know sometimes we do that if you're in a negative state, we'll have you describe it because it pulls you out of it. But if you want to work with it or try to figure out what's going on, you know, when they start describing it, then it can counteract the problem. So let's do a quick thing. What's the different levels of guilt? First, you have healthy guilt, right? And a lot of these things, because again, remember, we are social creatures, and the whole idea of a lone wolf is bullshit, right? And if someone says they're a lone wolf, they've been shamed there's something going on underneath that pulls them away from their group. Because human beings, by nature, much like a lot of the primates, cannot survive very well on their own. We need to be part of a group, a tribe, a system, if you will, village, right? And if you get thrown out, that's a death sentence. It wasn't that long ago if you got thrown out of your group, your tribe, your family, it was literally a death sentence for being... To being outed of that community was a death sentence. It's why it's so strong, right? And it's why it's built into us to keep us in a group, in a system, in whatever it is. So, and it's one of the ultimate survival mechanisms. And we'll talk about that, right? But it's, but let's look at it differently. First of all, there's healthy guilt. Basically, you did something that was socially or objectively wrong. You know, of course, I know it'll change by socials and cultures, but it's wrong. It would get you ostracized from the group, penalized by the group. And it, there, in good, healthy guilt, you take responsibility and you change your behavior. You know, you did something wrong, you correct your behavior, right? And then you can forgive yourself when you correct your behavior. I won't do that again, right? So that's basically healthy guilt. Keeps you in line. It's what keeps cultures growing and going and doing all those kind of things. And it could be from the external and somewhat internal. And then there's, but then there's unhealthy guilt, which is basically you have unreal standards, you know? You're trying to please adults who have unreal standards, right? And then basically it's perfectionism, you know, because you have a standard that's basically unreachable, like perfectionism. And so then you feel guilty that you can't achieve it, right? And then also with it kind of goes with the next level, which is shame, which is you're fundamentally flawed or worthless. And a guilt is I made a mistake. Again, shame is I am a mistake, right? And shame goes one level more where you want to withdraw, you want to pull inward because somehow you feel defective. You want to disappear. So you pull in, right? And again, when you get into unhealthy guilt or even shame, a lot of it is you beat yourself up for you don't know what you don't know. You know, if you make a mistake and you didn't know it was a mistake, you could say, I didn't know that. And then you correct the behavior. I didn't know the speed limit was 25 here. You'll get a penalty, but you'll correct the behavior. You don't beat yourself. I should have known. God damn, I should have known. But how many times do we see people beat ourselves up, even though we don't know? I should have known how to do that. Why would you know how to do that, right? If you don't know how to do it, you don't know how to do it. And this goes back to unhealthy guilt and or shame, right? So what are some of the issues that come with this? Well, basically, and a lot of this comes from me studying addictions, but then when I spread out from the addiction world, and again, my internet may be going in and out, so it might be pixelating. I apologize. You feel hollow inside. Many times you hear people with an addiction talk about they have a hole in their soul, a hole in their heart, an empty heart. That's where I got the title, the empty heart, right? And then if it's an addictive, maladaptive behavior, which is what an addiction is, you know, alcohol, drugs, eating, sex, toxic relationship, it seems to fill that hole. It's why your addicts and alcoholics say the first time they had that drink or got high was the only time they felt normal. Or they only feel normal when they're in a toxic relationship because they're treating me the way I feel I should. I'm hollow inside. Yeah, I feel like a fraud. So that's, you know, whether it's alcohol, drugs, all of the addictions, all of those kind of things, the toxic relationships, also self-sabotaging everything. You never quite achieve at the high level because first of all, you're going to set an unrealistic expectation for it maybe, but even if you start feeling, you start achieving it because you feel hollow on the inside, it doesn't feel connected and you self-sabotage it, right? It's kind of like talking to someone after I started thinking about this and talking about this with people. And this person goes, well, I never do anything right. Da, 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 da. And if you try to, and I knew this person, so I'm pointing out some of the things they do right. It's why what most therapists do is wrong. And I was guilty of it. And they're like, they pointed out the 3 or 4 things that they were vastly successful at. And they kind of went, yeah, but that's really not like me. You know, what's really like me is the, not good enough, right? So let's talk a little bit about the neurobiology of shame, you know, or toxic guilt, right? And even guilt a little bit, right? But when it gets to the next level, it has the same physiological responses that are very similar, if not exactly similar, to true life threats, right? And what really happens when it really kicks into the highest level, you lose your ability to have your control over voluntary behaviors. You can't move, You know, it gets to the deeper part of the brain. You know, you have fight, flight, or freeze, right? And when you get down to that freeze kind of thing, that is where you totally just pull inside yourself. And when you're feeling it, it's like you've been kicked in the gut. So you feel it, it's felt below the diaphragm, right? And anything can set it off, real or vividly imagined, but the neurobiology is your system shuts down. That's what begins to happen, right? And again, there's no defense, right? And once it kicks in, there's no defense. Some people withdraw because of shame, right? It's debilitating. And if it isn't handled in childhood or after a trauma, right, which often happens, it goes unregulated. And then it can begin to attach itself to things that are close, right? And again, so one way to think about it, when these things are set in, children have no defense against it. You know, they'll internalize it. That, you know, because mommy and daddy are fighting, it means I'm a bad child, therefore I'm worthless. You know, mommy and daddy are divorcing, it's my fault. I didn't please them, I'm worthless. So children don't have a defense, right? Something said to a kid by a teacher, a coach, an authority figure, a parent, other family member, it'll go in. And there's no defense because you don't have the defense mechanisms developed yet. And also, even as an adult, and this happens at any age, when you're in high trauma, you have no defense against it. And that's why people get post-traumatic stress after a car wreck. People go to combat or get caught up in violent situations. There's no defense. Your brain shuts down. You go into that and you end up, you know, and it cues, if you will, hiding and retreating from others to try to stay alive because you don't want to be seen because that will cause more pain, you know. And the only comment I'll make that's somewhat political, what's going on in America with all the gun violence, we're teaching kids how to hide, to pull down, to withdraw, to become invisible. You know, and that's really what made me want to start talking about. I'm like, God damn, we're teaching them basically how to become totally shame-based human beings, right? So you know, someone that goes through a horrible event like that, they'll go, I should have known better. I should have been able to do this. Yeah, I should have been able to hide. It's fascinating, right? So there's no defense against it once it gets set in. And basically, I call it a felt sense. You feel it, and it's a sense. And sometimes you can't put words to it. You know, it's almost indescribable. It's just a sense. And again, going back to it's a loaded word, you know, so I have nothing to feel shame or guilt about. Maybe you don't. Doesn't mean you don't feel it. You know, then you're intellectualizing it, right? It's underneath it. And it's that inner sense of unworthiness, unlovable, incompetent, of not being of any value. And it's a reflection, if you will, of the relationship we had when we were developing, maybe as children. And again, I'm not about blame, but parents, authority figures, teachers, coaches, family members, things like that. Or what I would call impactful years when you're going through high stress situations. You know, you could be an adult, but you're going through a high stress situation, right? So your body will throw it down and you may end up turning it into this basically like a shame message. And so a lot of these things we get, is it a message you actually heard growing up that your father, teacher, mom, coach, someone said, or is it that you, maybe they said it, did they say it to you? You know, it's just fascinating. It's a felt sense and it can impact you later on. Now, insight doesn't really work. You know, we'll bring the shame to the surface or the event. Now you'll look at it as an adult and realize that little you couldn't have defended yourself, or that person that got beat up or raped or in some trauma. You know, you can look at it objectively and the insight would change it. That's not true. All the research and everything, it doesn't work. It just makes you insightful. In fact, people may agree with you consciously, and it's like a hardening effect. They're agreeing with you here, and it's becoming harder here. you know, because now you're, because all sometimes it comes across as judgmental from the people trying to do this to you, right? It's why if someone's really in shame, in guilt, in that toxic place right then, responding with love is our, is actually counterproductive, you know, because they can't feel it. They have they're shut down. It's like, you know, and it can compound it, right? So basically, it's a process to come out of this. You know, it's not insight specific, an antidote where you can just point out, here's the connection to what happened to you when you were younger, or when you were in trauma, or when you were in combat, when you were attacked, the car wreck, and here you are now. It doesn't connect, right? And trauma is, and what you see in shame is a very specific body posture. It's an autonomic pattern, which is similar to what you see in trauma, right? And again, like I say, love is the wrong response, right? Because someone that's in a posture of shame, toxic guilt, when they pull in like this, and or they want to withdraw, right? They're pulling away from it. And when you try to reach out with love, if you will, with caring and compassion, it can have a counterproductive thing. I'm not saying it might, especially at the beginning, right? It's much more impactful if you change the posture of it and then the heart opens up, then you can help to reprogram. Because shame is basically a meaning-making belief system, right? And self-blame is universal in chronic trauma, right? And because so many people are traumatized by so many, many things, and again, you can't judge someone else's trauma by what you've been through. Some people, I don't know why they're in, how can they have post-traumatic stress? It was only a little fender bender. I don't know. Some people can have that. And then we'll add guilt to it. You know, I recently heard a politician kind of say, well, some people just aren't that strong and they're going to get post-traumatic stress. And you're like, first of all, you don't know what's going on, right? And what that level of trauma is. And then what begins to happen, because we judge it itself, the feeling of toxic guilt, toxic relationships, shame, self-loathing, and that shame and that self-loathing, that feeling of unworthiness. Again, I apologize, my internet connection is kind of going in and out. And it becomes the central issue in chronic trauma, right? And then it's not the event, but the relationship people have with their inner selves. And what happens, you have a traumatic event, traumatic period of your life, it becomes the filter everything else goes through. So then someone looks at you funny, it'll activate that feeling of shame. Someone looks at you, if you are like the victim of a rape, molestation, right? Someone looks at you longingly, you know, with romantic interest, even if it's benign, but they're interested in you. It's going through that filter where, oh my God, and it fires up all those horrible feelings of self-loathing and shame, right? And this is why people do weight loss. I've done it. A lot of people have done it, where you see people drop a lot of weight, and then, you know, let's say they're, and I always think of a client I had. She was about 150 pounds overweight. She dropped 100 pounds. She was still overweight. She's a very physically beautiful woman, right? And then when she dropped that weight, you know, she got pretty close to her goal. She disappeared. And the next time she came back in, she put on like 50 pounds. And really what happened with her was after she lost that weight, she goes, one day at work, they got a new UPS driver. She was worked in an office and took the packages. And suddenly the UPS driver starts flirting with her. And she felt so guilty and so shame-based about that because she was married. She's basically in a toxic relationship, but she's married. And suddenly here's this, you know, rather attractive UPS guy who's kind of gregarious and outgoing, and he's flirting with her. And that went through that prism of guilt and shame because she was molested and then she had some other toxic relationships. So therefore, you know, it went in, fired up that feeling she wanted to pull in. Now, her way of pulling in was to put padding on to push people away, right? And so she came back when she started putting on the weight, and then we were ready to look at it and do some other things, right? And again, it's about separation. It's a survival mechanism, right? And it, again, at these deep levels of mind, logic goes out the window, right? And one of the, you know, it's been thought that would help is just to help people make a very clear differentiation between who they are right now and that event, right? And then what they had to do to survive, right? Because they're beating themselves up because I was weak, I should have fought back. A lot of times you see very angry, bitter people because maybe something happened in their lives, and their response to it is they hate any kind of perceived weakness because they hate that weak part of themselves, right? So that's people that become very harsh and judgmental, even though they might have been in a situation they couldn't have defended against. They couldn't have defended against, you know? So they're going to become very harsh with other people because they hate that feeling of being vulnerable. You know, maybe their first love, you know, betrayed them, right? And so now they're very harsh and judgmental in all relationships. Then when they see people in love, they make fun of it, right? Because it's a survival mechanism. So basically you have to re-script the event and the in all the processes with it. Right. And again, this first little webinar, I'm just putting it out there, ideas. I'm working on something with it. Right. So you can reframe or redo it, you know, but shame or the unworthiness feeling, feeling flawed, defective, can also develop through the absence of good, not just the presence of bad. So what that means is, to me, it means, bad things can happen, trauma, abuse, that's going to give you shame, guilt, remorse, especially if you internalize it. Well, they attacked me because I deserved it. You know, my family threw me out because I don't deserve it. So, you know, there was bad action, bad events, right? But what if there's just an absence of the good where you don't feel loved? And again, if you're the person, one of your primary caregivers is very harsh and judgmental, and not accepting of who you are, that will make you feel shame, right? And it could be, that's why they say it's generational, you know, but if you don't feel loved, you don't feel accepted. And again, you know, it's not judging, it's just looking, you know, it's kind of like, you know, in this one, everybody can be guilty, but it's nobody's fault. You know, again, because your parents or the caregivers, teachers, authority figures, they were taught the way they were taught. So they're passing it on, right? But again, if it comes in that you're not loved, you're not accepted, you're distant, you don't know how to have a relationship. I know there was a study done with men in England, upper class men, that were sent to boarding schools, you know, and usually about the eight, you know, sometimes quite young, 6, 7, you know, and they were taught discipline and honor and all that. Well, they became very productive citizens, but when they ended up being harsh, judgmental, and distant, because in those developmental years, they weren't there, you know. And again, it doesn't matter if it's a real or a vividly imagined event. It's if these filters are being set and they're going through those filters, boom, it's going to explode. You know, we see that a lot with children that go through where their parents split up, right? And it depends on the age where the parents split up. They internalize it. It's their fault. And of course, and then, you know, you're trying to tell a 7-year-old that it's not their fault. You know, they may internalize it. And then they'll grow up and they won't trust people. You'll see one of your caregivers basically destroy another one. If not physically, physical abuse, you'll internalize that. Could be emotional abuse, could be emotional neglect, it could be all kinds of things. So, and again, one way to reframe it a little bit is if an experience that people have that's meant to motivate them to change in some way, that should allow them to reconnect with others, but instead it causes them to pull back from others, right? Now we can know all this consciously, but it doesn't really work at the subconscious level. So what you have to do is you have to reprogram the subconscious mind. You know, I always say change your mind, change your life, but it's a lot more difficult than people make it out to be. Well, one of the things that works is the power of groups. Because when you get in a group and you have shared experiences, and this is why I'll use like a 12-step program, AA or Alcoholics Anonymous or Narcotics Anonymous, and that where, and you'll always hear like people that get in those programs say the first time they could share about drinking the way they drank and people accepted them without saying, you're crazy. That's shameful. How could you do that? You know, you left your two young babies and alone with your 10-year-old child. That's shameful. And so they don't want to share. And you get in a group and you'll get some support. You know, it's not that they agree with the behavior, but they know what it's like. There's that shared connection because people talk about connections. And again, if you're coming from this place, you can't connect up here. Maybe you need to connect right here, right now, and right here, right now, right here, right now. And people with shared experiences can do that. And when it even comes from trauma, some of the research says the best supportive ways for veterans, let's use that, with post-traumatic stress is groups led by people that are full of people with post-traumatic stress from combat. They share it. They understand what it's like. Other people might not. Right? And I don't want to tell horror stories, but it makes sense, right? Or even, you know, people that share information. There was, right after September 11th, 2001, when the attacks happened in New York City, there was a lot of research done on how we're going to help all these people. I mean, you know, 23,000 people died in the towers. Right. And it was traumatic as heck. Right. The power, not just the people killed in the towers, but then, you know, people saw it. They saw the planes flying into the towers. You saw people jumping to their deaths from the towers. And then, you know, people, a lot of, if you lived in that area, everybody, most people knew someone that might've got killed in those things. So it's horrible. And so they geared up for, you know, what's going to help these people. Of course, you know, the psychiatrists, all these people got together and they came up with a plan. And the two things they could recommend, if I remember right, was basically Freudian psychoanalysis and cognitive behavioral therapy. And a couple of reasons for that. One is the Freudian thing. New York City is still the base of that. So basically it was a politically connected group, and cognitive behavioral was the most powerful group in that psychology and that. So that's what was recommended. Well, then I think it was 2 years later, they went back and found very few people reached out for help. So when they went back and found some of the people that went through the trauma that were doing well, that were willing to talk about it, they talked about things like massage. They started going to massage. They started taking yoga, martial arts, Qigong. They joined groups where they talked about it. You know, for a while they had survivors groups that at first were shunned by some people, but then people could talk about the feeling of loss, the feeling of this. You know, people shared it, and it got out, right? So there was that, right? So that's one of the ways out, is shared experience, groups, reconnecting, feeling needed, right? And again, as the general thing is, one of the best ways to help people out of that is if they can connect with something that gives them a mission greater than themselves. Because when you're helping another, and again, you go back to 12-step programs, you go back to some of those, even spiritual groups that do outreach to other people, it's the idea of feeling needed. Especially if you're in a family and you felt like you were a burden, you weren't supposed to be there, you were a mistake, right? So suddenly you're around, you know, people that are helping. It's why also there was a study done with why like equine therapy does so well for PTSD veterans. They feel needed by their horse. They're taking care of their horse. You know, some of the program pilot programs done in prisons where they give prisoners abused dogs, right? They work great. They work great. The research is fabulous. Of course, what does our government here in America do? They cut the funding for that stuff. So anyway, it's the idea of feeling needed. Shame is the labeling that gets people caught up, you know? And basically, I did something bad, therefore I am bad. That's the second level. You know, if there was something went on and it was a bad thing, therefore I'm a bad person, you know? This is especially true in ex-convicts groups, addiction groups, things like that. The behavior was bad. Does that mean you're a bad person, right? Or did you just do a bad thing? Right? And a lot of this is about being accepted, because one of the true ways around shame, guilt, and unworthiness is feeling accepted. So I just wanted to do a quick thing. I'm just kind of really beginning to experiment with this and look at some cool new things. So there'll be more to come as we grow. I'll probably do another webinar in a week or so. I may offer a class because it's one of the things. And again, it spins out of what I love to do. And my big focus will be, you know, on the shame, guilt, remote unworthiness, will be on people that self-sabotage success. That's what I'm looking at. You know, you get to this level and you blow it up, so you have to drop back. You get to this and you drop back. You get the boom, you know. And I was really thinking about that recently when I decided to do this webinar, because there was an athlete who got suspended from the league he was in for substance abuse issues, right? So he goes through treatment, gets clean and sober, gets reinstated. In fact, I think this happened twice. But anyway, and I mean, it's a pro athlete, so making millions of dollars, right? Yeah, he just got suspended again. And then a story happened just the other day. Another guy got suspended and may never get back into the pro sport that he was a part of. And I'm watching the news, well, this is crazy. How could you do that? People, well, you know, it's an addiction. They could talk about whatever it was, but it's, could there be self-sabotage? Could there be self-sabotage, right? Yes. You know, and I heard one athlete talk about, it was a movie star. And what got him into getting treatment and help was he kept getting in trouble, right? And he would get his career right here, and then he would blow it up. And, you know, he goes, I was making great money. I'm an actor. I'm in TV. I'm in movies. I got money. So if I do drink, why do I not take, this was before Uber, why didn't I call a cab? I could hire a limo guy, you know, and he'd make fun of his friends that would get a driver for the night, right? I'm going to drive. Well, you know, and then get lit up, and then your picture's in the paper. And, you know, and for a while he said, I tried to play it off as a guy, play it off as, you know, funny and stuff. But then he couldn't get cast in the big budgets because the guy funding the movie wants to insure in case something happens that there's insurance to cover it in case something bad happens, right? So we get reimbursement, right? And I mean, there was that one movie, the guy broke his ankle in filming the movie, and the movie star got shut down for like 6 weeks. And it was like at least $1 million a day while the movie was shut down. And so, but they had insurance because the actor wasn't high risk. So the movie got put on hold, but the insurance kicked in. So the producers, you know, didn't have to pay out all that money, you know, the director and all the other actors and the crew. You can't just say, go away, come back in 6 weeks. You know, they might not come back. So anyway, you know, he talked about things like that, right? So, you know, that self-sabotage, you get to this point and then you blow it up. You know, you get in a relationship and it's working good and then you blow it up. In fact, I was talking to a friend who reach out to a friend, person I knew in a group I'm involved in, and they're like, God, I did it again. You know, he found her, it was a girl. She goes, I'm dating this guy. He's really nice. You know, he's caring, compassionate. I didn't know what to do. And basically, she went out with another guy, and he found out and he ended the relationship. She goes, but nothing. At first, she was very just, you know, nothing happened. I didn't do this and this and this. You know, but I go, why did you do that if you're getting into a good relationship, you know? And it was because she felt unworthy. And then when the relationship got this level underneath it, as we worked through it, she goes, well, I guess underneath it, I thought, well, if it's going to go bad, I'm going to blow it up, not him, right? So that's the kind of thing. That's what I'm working on. That's what I want to explore. And that the next webinar will be coming up about that. So I just hope everybody enjoyed just this little talk. I recorded it, so I'll put it up somewhere for people to watch. I'll put it on Facebook, and I'll see you all soon. Those on the call, you can stay on the call.